Tonight we are learning from the light with Dr. John Lermer. We're going to be talking with him about pre-death experiences, prophecies, angelic messages, and hope. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. Tonight, Dr. John Lermer, widely known for his compassionate and loving care of hundreds of terminally ill patients, as well as his tenure as the inpatient medical director for the internationally renowned Medical Center Hospice of Houston, Texas. Since the inpatient unit is located in the heart of the largest medical center in the world, he worked closely with MD Anderson Hospital, the leading cancer institute in the world in research and teaching. Here is Dr. John Lermer. John, welcome back, my friend. How are you?
Pretty good, George. Nice hearing your voice again.
You too. What have you been up to?
Well, just finished writing my book and been out in L.A. lately, actually working on a documentary about the book, about the messages that my patients are leaving. And it's been a lot of fun being out there.
John, when you went into medical school and then ultimately became a doctor, did you ever expect to go in the direction that you are now going?
Not at all.
No. I mean, how did that happen? What led you down this path?
Not at all. You know, I'm asked that question all the time, and it's just one of those things that happens in people's lives where you're directed by some unseen force to a place where you know you're going to be, or they know you're going to be happier in. And that's a big part of the message. But how did it happen? You know, I was going to be an OB-GYN initially, wanted to be a doctor all my life, and didn't go that route because I don't necessarily believe in abortions, that a doctor should have to do them. And back then they would force us to do them as physicians, mm-hmm. to go through them. And I think that's the most horrible thing that, you know, that we have to do. If you don't believe in them, you shouldn't do them. And so I rerouted, and I guess divinely so, rerouted myself into internal medicine, and that led me into an arena where, at that period of time in the 80s, there was the epidemic of AIDS, and what a horrible thing it was. I mean, it's almost somewhat like what's going on. I mean, imagine just instead of just wearing the mask for this new swine flu, or the H1N1, I mean, you'd have to wear a whole body suit because we didn't know what it was. We didn't know how it was being spread. And so I'm walking into these rooms and trying to comfort these people. You know, they taught us in medical school to never judge anybody. You treat everybody the same. And yet, how do you do that wearing these outfits?
You scare the heck out of them, don't you?
Yeah, that form a wall. Yeah, you know, and they're already dying, and it's just horrible, and we didn't know what it was. We didn't know what was going on. And so to think that was just really not too long ago, I think people quickly forget. My patients tell me that very frequently as part of the prophecies that are going to happen in the future, that the world, it's not that we're being punished or anything like that. It's just that we're not working together. And there's a new life systems theory that's coming out and a new paradigm and with scientists that we need to look at each other as interconnected, especially with the unified field theory coming out, the new quantum theory coming out. And because of that, the life systems, the world itself, will do things that it needs to do to survive. Just like we have to do things to survive to keep our family alive, the world will do what it needs to do. And think about this swine flu. I mean, if it really goes out, epidemic, and which it's not going to do that.
No,
not with
and
it's not
just, I don't believe it either.
No, and it's not. And this has been really overdone, and I can tell you probably why. I think we all know why, but from a political...
Go ahead, say it.
Politically, they don't want us to know what's going on. I'm telling you, as a doctor, we lose more people through regular flu. Right now, today, people are dying from other flus.
Yes.
Other than that one. Okay? Now, if you were to ask one of those guys on whatever, CNN, NBC, well, how many people have died from regular flu today, not the swine flu? Well, today we probably lost 1,000.
Okay? You know,
how would that
be? And they don't know that. And if you heard that, you would think that we had an epidemic in this country alone.
Yeah. And that's the big, you know, George, it's just disgusting.
You know, John, I had a theory years ago when we were talking about wars in Iraq and what was happening in Lebanon at the time. And I was talking to a group of people, and this was when we had homicides in this country every year at around 25,000. 25,000 Americans were killed or murdered in homicides in this country every year, about 25,000, according to FBI statistics. Okay. And I told them, if they read a headline that said in France, or in, granted we have a big country, but even in China or in the Soviet Union at the time, 25,000 Russians were murdered last year, you would think the country was gone in total disarray. Mm-hmm. When I told them that 25,000 Americans were killed every year in this country, mm-hmm. they couldn't believe it. It sounds like it was under civil war. Statistics fool people if they're not aware of them. And you're right. You're right about the flu.
It does, and it creates public opinion, which is what they're trying to do. But, you know, I really, really have faith in people. Obviously, the media doesn't, or they think that. I'm sure there's some people that are still somewhat fooled. But you know what? I don't blame them. They're taking care of their kids. They have little children. You know, they're supposed to trust the media. This is the United States. It's supposed to be, you know, now supposed to be transparent, but it's not. You know, and then they're lying to you. And then if a doctor comes out, like I was interviewed by one of the major stations, TV stations, and they didn't put my interview out because I told them the truth.
They did the interview but decided not to air it, huh?
Because I was telling them, you know how many more people are dying from the regular flu today? Why aren't you reporting that? And so they didn't put it. And so, and it's happened many, many times that I've been interviewed. I always tell them the truth. And, you know, it's just the way it is. And it's the way this world is. It's the United States where we're heading. But it's going to change. I have to tell you, George, I believe my patients, you know, doing this for so many, many years, and such lovely people that have passed on to leave these messages for me. And for the world, and that's why I wanted to share them in these books.
Great.
With that, we are heading. There is hope. Like you said, you know, I was listening to part of your messages, you know, earlier as I was listening to the radio. It is going to get better. It is going to get better, but it's just not going to get better the way it was before. You know, it's just like at 9/11, you know, people got better. They were loving each other, was working, and then after 2 months, you go back to where you're at.
Mm-hmm.
We are moving slowly. We're evolving, and we can get into this later. But we are evolving into our higher awareness, into our spiritual self. You know, that part of ourself that physics now is really coming out and saying we're all unified.
You know, I agree with that, and I see that a lot at conferences I go to, where there are many, many coast-to-coast listeners there. But I also think, though, John, that you know, people who listen to this program, people that you know, they're higher tuned. I mean, they're in a class by themselves, where people who aren't aware of these topics or the subject matter, they're not into this. They don't understand it. But that group that does, they're very well tuned into this.
Absolutely, and some of the, you know, and it doesn't even have to be a prophecy. Come on, George, you and I can say, you know, we've known where the humans have come from, where we are at just in the last 100 years, where we're heading, that we are going to change. You know, our appendix used to be 10, 11 inches long, you know, in the caveman times because they needed it. Now we no longer need it to be that long to keep the intestine from being obstructed. So it's, you know, an inch long, and maybe in the next 1,000 years, we won't have an appendix any longer because our food is refined. And so if that's just a physical part of our body, what about our mind, which is still physical? What is changing in our mind as well?
I hope our minds are getting bigger and not smaller.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, there's no doubt. And we are connecting, and we are heading, no doubt, into wisdom. You know, into the, you know, they call the age of wisdom, but it's, you know, what was this, the survival of the fittest? You know, that's what we're working under. The reductionist scientists are working under that. that theory. It really, it's shifting now.
Did it ever bother you?
Survival of the wisdom. So that's where it's heading.
When you got involved in dealing with so many people with death, did that ever bother you? I mean, was there ever a point where you went, I just can't take this anymore?
You know, maybe once or twice when there were little children that I got really close to.
Yeah.
Other than that, no, because I have such a strong belief in the afterlife. I have a strong belief in, you know, from my physics background, that there is a minefield, that there is an entanglement of sorts. There is that Einstein paradox. All of that is proven, you know, mathematically. I know we're heading somewhere. Also, you know, with the research, and we'll get into that later. Now I even know more, and I already believe it, but I want to get it out there along with a lot of other doctors who are really coming together now. You know, Bruce Grayson, Peter Fenwick, Dr. Schwartz. I mean, they're just countless other doctors. Dr. von Pimmel from Germany. People are just getting together, and we're trying to get a big conference together in New York that'll start going around with the major minds that are doing this, from hospice to physicists, and going around the world and giving these talks on the quantum brain, that it is no longer just confined to the brain, to the skull, that there is telepathy, that there is something else, that there is the space-time continuum of sorts. There is a fabric of knowledge that exists out of us, and that is the truth, and which is God, you know. I believe that's what, you know, where all religions come together and wedded together is on that belief that there is something greater outside of us.
And you believe that there is another side. I believe that there's something on the other side. What do you think it is, though, John?
Well, I think, you know, when I talk to my patients, okay, when I was talking, let's just go back with those thousands of AIDS patients I cared and I watched die without any hospice. And back there, it was just getting started. The United States never wanted to really, devote its money and time to the dying. You know, it's like, okay, let's just teach people, cure people, and and if not, let's just put them in the nursing home. And so, you know, we've neatly tucked away death or near death into these buildings. And you can be driving by them every day, but there's probably about 20 people that are dying a day by a nursing home you pass every day. And so, you know, the point is that Europe has had it. Hospice has existed a long time ago. In fact, from a Christian standpoint, where Jesus was, you know, in the manger, that was actually called a hospice. Okay. And that's where the term really comes from. It's a comfort place. And that's what we want to do. We want to comfort, and medicine is about not just comforting them physically or curing them, but let's take care of their mind, their body, their spirit. And so when I was taking care of these my AIDS patients and with these darn, you know, big old gowns and suits that look like
you're in the movie Outbreak or Breakout or whatever
I'm
that was called.
You, it's like those alien movies or something, you know, where, you know, there's a big nuclear disaster, you know. But, you know, I would take it out. I understood it, and I just said, well, let me just, you know, if I don't touch anything, I just keep my mask on, that's fine. So I'd go talk to these people, and I touched them, and I realized they were dying, and they needed comfort. And that's when I started to understand that this is what I wanted to do. But the field did not exist yet up until two or three years ago. Can you believe that? That the American Board of Medical Specialties just agreed that death was needed to be a specialty.
That is amazing.
That we needed a doctor to address their pain. I mean, not just physical, but their existential, you know. No one knows. You know, they tell you, okay, this is what's going to happen if you have cancer. This is what's going to happen if you take this drug. But, hey, doc, what's going to happen when I die? Well, no one's asking it either.
Do you think most people, right before they die, John, I mean, right before, when they know what's happening, and you know, and you're going to have to take us through the physical form of that, as I'm curious about this, but are they afraid?
Yes. Pretty much everyone that I come across, there's the two components to death. You know, there's the physical part, and that's what they're scared of, the main portion of it. The spiritual side, you know, they're saying, am I going to go anywhere? The existential side. Well, I'll worry about that later. Right now, am I going to? The number one fear, okay, of symptomatology is suffocation. Am I going to suffocate? And everyone, invariably everyone that can talk, that comes into my service, you know, I've taken care of thousands and thousands now. I already know, so I'll even tell them before they even ask me, but they all tell me, am I going to suffocate, doctor? And they've.
Well, what's the answer to that?
And the answer is no, you're not. If you have a doctor who is willing to sit with you and get to know your disease process, so say you and understands where is that disease process going to go in terms of how are you going to die, you know? And that's what the specialty is about. Is they teach us to know all the disease states and how that disease state kills a person.
I mean, do the lights just go out and you're gone?
And so, yes, let's just say you're dying from a kidney failure. Okay, well, your kidneys release fluid. And eventually it's going to fail enough to where you're not releasing fluid. Our bodies are made up of 80% water. That water's still going to be utilized, but now you can't excrete it. And yet some of it comes off your skin and breathing, but most of it doesn't. And so it's going to go into your lungs. And we're talking, so if you weigh 100 pounds, and most people are weighing about between 80 to 100 pounds, let's just say with cancer as they die. So 100 pounds, they have 80 pounds of water still in them. So can you imagine? Your whole lungs can't hold all that. So that's what ends up happening. So if I go in there, oh, my gosh, you have kidney failure, you know what? Don't worry about it. I'm going to keep that fluid off of you. You know, I'm going to do what I need to do.
Medically,
yeah,
right?
Medically, that's the first thing we want to do is try to get them to trust me. And I'll say, you know what? I know words are only words, but let me give you something. And this is where you develop, the doctor, all hospice doctors now that are board certified are wonderful, that they're really connecting with their patients and they say, finally, you give them something and it works. And the key drug at the very end, and this is where families come in and really they start coming in and saying, no, we don't want that, is the word, when you use the word morphine, morphine, Dilaudid, methadone, all those big time pain medicines. But we know now through research, because now the government's giving us money to do research on death and dying, you know, on different types of pain. How do you die? How do we comfort the people? And so we know now that morphine and any other pain medicine, like morphine, will cut the nerve that senses, that tells your brain you're suffocating. So there was a test done where these docs took some morphine, they went underwater, see how long they could breathe without developing that anxiety and fear. Well, they never really felt it. And so we know that you can still be full of fluid, but as long as you're getting the morphine, you're never going to suffocate. My dad died a year ago. He was full of fluid all the way up to his lungs. I took care of him. He didn't want any of us taking care of him. We gave him the medicine. Of course, my mom says, no, don't give it to him, and that there's always that obstacle, but
right,
I talked to
right.
her. And so we did, and my dad was smiling with all of his lungs full of fluid.
Do you talk with them about the other side before they die?
Absolutely. So once you do that, you just sort of develop a sense, Art, and George, and it comes. I know.
They all do that. That's a compliment. Hey, John, stay with us. We're going to take this break. We'll be right back. John, before we get into some more of these incredible stories, you and I, of course, share a dear friend, Whitley Strieber. I think the world of him.
Yeah, what a great man he is.
Super, super. How'd you get to know him?
Here in San Antonio, years ago, and just got out of internal medicine residency, and where I was talking about the AIDS patients, and moved from Austin to San Antonio, and just actually started. I had some extra time, and I just started reading. My desire to know more about the esoteric things like that led me into Whitley's books. And then one day I just said, you know, I'd really love to meet him. He lives here in San Antonio. And just within 2 weeks of saying that, a lady walks in who knew him, who was in his group study, connected us. And we're really, really good friends now. And he's in L.A., you know, out in California now, the L.A. area. And his career has just really done really
well.
Oh,
my God. And I guess you could say he was sort of a patient, right?
Absolutely. And so that was the coolest part about it, because, you know, you put that intention out there. Back then, I didn't know anything with, you know, putting intentions out there, the quantum field, all that. You know, it's like, okay, whatever. But I put out an intention that's what I wanted to meet, and I did. And they were putting out an intention. They needed a physician to look at some of these people's scoop marks, these abductees. They had this little group of abductees. It was a very private group, and I believe a couple of them were astronauts, you know, from the NASA area. You know, we were right here in San Antonio.
Yeah.
And they met every so often, so it was not too far for them to drive. And there was a few policemen, a few lawyers. So it was really incredible, and Whitley was there. And along with a good friend of ours, Constance Clear, who's since has passed. You know, it was at that point they needed us, and Whitley said, hey, how about looking at this little thing I have on my ear? And I did, and I said, well, it looks like it's a little cyst. And he goes, well, do you mind if you can excise it? And I said, sure, no problem.
You're the one, aren't you?
And so I'm thinking, okay, it's a cyst, okay? I was reading some of his other books, but I had not read Communion.
Right.
Or watched the movie, so I wasn't really quite sure what that was all about. But his wife shows up with a camera and everything there in our little OR.
That's him.
And he goes, you don't mind if I bring in the camera and everything? And sure enough, I go, go for it. So, you know, we do our thing, and I start cutting it. And he goes, just talk and just tell it the way it is. Whatever happens, just express it, so that the people, whoever watches in the future, will know what you're thinking. And so as I start to anesthetize it, and then I make my incision right over the cyst, which I had really done a good exam. It was really stuck in the cartilage. And I needed to know that, because if it moved around a lot, I'd really have to get different appliances.
Absolutely. I mean, because then you're into something serious.
Yeah, and I said, you know, okay, so it was a fix. I said, this is going to be easy. I'm going to make an incision right around it, and I'm going to just excise it, cut it out. Well, so I'd excise it, I exposed it, and, you know, when you cut something in the body, there's blood. So you really, people would say, well, what did it look like? Well, initially it just looks like a bunch of blood and skin tissue and so forth until I cut it. And I did grab a piece of it, but as soon as I did, it popped out of its little groove that apparently it was affixed to.
It ran away from you, didn't it?
Yeah. And I said, okay, well, maybe that's possible. Okay, fine. So I grabbed a piece of it. I put in the formalin solution to send to the pathologist and said, well, let me grab the rest of it. But it already snuck under the skin that was not incised. And I said, oh, shoot. Whitley, do you mind if I cut a little more here? I said, man, I don't want to be Mike Tyson here, okay?
You know? Yeah.
So, and he goes, go for it. And his wife, like, right there with the camera and looking at that, and it was really...
You did numb him, I assume, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
it was rather funny, you know. You know, he's just the funniest guy you'll ever meet, too. So I cut, and I go, well, I'm going to grab it this time. But In reviewing the film, that first time I grabbed it, I said, oh, my God, it's like it moved. And I remember saying that.
And I've witnessed seeing that when Dr. Roger Lear does these. These things move away. They're almost like they've got a sensor, and they don't want to be caught.
They want to be taken out.
Yeah.
And that was Whitley's biggest concern. He really struggled about this for years because it was in 96 that I tried to remove it somewhere in that vicinity. And this happened, what, in the late 80s up in New York through an abduction?
I was just with him and Anne in Vancouver, Canada, and he was pointing out where it was. Yeah, it's right. Still in there.
Yeah, and so, yeah, and this, he had experienced something that someone had put that in there, you know, aliens and military, and that, you know, he still wasn't quite sure, but this thing bothered him a lot. It would turn on, it would heat up, and it'd heat up his ear and part of the side of his head. And, you know, there are some disease processes that I know that exist, and it could be anything like in the connective tissue lupus kind of disease. So we proved all that and discarded all that, and that was non-existent. And so anyway, going back there, I cut it off. I cut that little part of the skin again. I go to grab it with these really fine tweezers, and it moves again. And this time I wasn't able to get hold of it. It was really sneaky now. It was really slippery. And I said, Whitley, it moved again. And I go, just cut it again. I think I cut it three times. And I said, by this point, it was down somewhere. You got to remember, this was all the way to the top, the back part of the ear, at the pinna.
What kind of a hole have you left in the poor guy?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the back of his ear, there's a big
gap. There's this gap there.
And I'm sure doctors asked, what happened? What doctor did that? We're not going to him. But no, but it landed all the way down to his lobe, the posterior, the back portion of his lobe. And I said, you know what, Willie, I'm stopping. I got a piece of it. Let me send it off. And that was good enough.
And so what was the pathology report? What did you ever find out?
Well, that was where when I knew that something, still I thought, okay, it might be a cyst. I mean, I still discarded it as who knows what, you know, but nothing out of this world. And until I got a call from the pathologist, who is a friend of mine, and they're at the hospital. And he called me, hey, Dr. Lerma, he goes, can we talk about this case? And he knew, he recognized Whitley's name. Well, you know, Whitley was very well known here in San Antonio and also through his books and so forth. And he goes, is this from Whitley Strieber? He's like, y'all playing a joke on me? And I go, no. And I was also taken aback by the call because pathologists don't ever call, even if it's cancer. They'll just leave you the report. They fax it over. Okay, it's cancer. And then we move from there and send him to the specialist. This time he calls me, and he really insisted. And he goes, I've got to tell you something. If this was not something, a joke, he goes, this is incredible. I had to look at it under the electron microscope. There's a piece of metal, circular metal, okay, and that I can see where you cut it, and you got a piece of it, sort of semi-circular, but you seem to get, you have gotten part, if not most, of the metal, and surrounding that metal are crystals that I've never seen, and they're not part of gouty crystals. What we were looking for was gout or pseudo-gout. They're not those crystals. I just don't know what to say. And outside of that ring, another shelf, are cilia.
Strange.
Like from a moving, living structure, almost amoeba-like. And he said, here's the other thing, putting the specimen in the formalin solution, nothing survives that. And so this thing's still moving. Under the electron microscope. And he goes, what do you want me to do with this? Bottom line, it's not cancer. It's not pseudo-gout. It's nothing you have to worry about, I think. I don't know what to do with this thing. And he goes, well, why don't you keep it? And we'll find, you know, I'll let you know. And so we talked to Whitley. And when I talked to Whitley, I said, wait, would you like it? We can maybe do some studies on it. And apparently by that point, when I called the pathologist back, it was gone. I mean, not from him. It was just gone.
John, tell us, in one of your first works, Into the Light.
Yes.
I think that's the one where you talked about a young boy named Matthew.
Mm-hmm.
From the MD Anderson Hospital, right?
That's correct.
Pretty. Tell us this story. This is an incredible, inspirational story.
Yeah. In fact, it's so incredible that... this Santis group, this group out of L.A. that's doing movies right now, they wanted to film that. And if people want to listen to it, I also have it on my website, drjohnlerman.com. And, you know, a Diane Duff and a Bruce Filaski and Nick Mendoza, the director and the executive producers, are doing such a great job in trying to get this message out. And they love that story so much, and that they just movie's not out yet, but they already have it out, and they want people to understand how a little kid like this, such an avatar, a sage, how he selflessly gave his life to save his mom's soul. And that's the whole story, what it's about. But so we'll talk, I think the name of the movie, just so that people know, is Quantum Wisdom.
Okay.
And they can look at that quantumwisdom.com, and if they want to look more into it. But it should be coming out in December sometime. And it's going to be a lot of these stories from myself. We're trying to get Dr. Schwartz. We have Dr. Few of the doctors, Dr. Peter Fenwick. We're going to get Daniel Brinkley on there. And we really want to move forward into getting people to understand what these people are telling, not just near death. People are I think people know enough about near death, but we don't know a whole lot about pre-death.
No, we don't. Well, what happened to Matthew?
And so in these pre-death, Matthew had probably the most incredible pre-death. His whole time there was incredible. And so this is a 9-year-old boy who, somewhere around the age of 6, was diagnosed with retinoblastoma, a cancer back in the retina. And so they thought, okay, let's enucleate the eye. In other words, let's cut it out, and you know, we'll save his life. And so they did. They tried some radiation first and all that. It didn't work, so they enucleated it. By that point, it already had spread to the second eye. So they enucleated the second eye in an attempt to improve the quality of his life, which I'm not sure how that really worked at that point.
Yeah,
losing
I know.
Both your eyes, which led him at that point to have this cancer now protruding out of his skull. And it was probably the size of a grapefruit or so forth. So when I get this gentleman from MD Anderson, who's working there at the Hospice Institute, I walk in, and it wasn't supposed to be my patient, mind you. It was supposed to be the pediatrician.
Sure.
But for the first time ever, she was gone. And I picked up on this patient, and lo and behold, apparently, according to him, that's the way it was meant to be. But I walk into the room, and this gentleman, who I'd already read probably thousands of pages of reports of who's all the treatments he had been through, but yet also what a great boy he was, the tremendous things he had done and the insightful and most profound statements he would make while he was in MD Anderson and the lives he had affected. So I said, well, man, this is awesome. I got, you know, I'm writing my book. It'd be great to get a story like that. And so I walk in, and this gentleman, you know, he don't have his eyes, but he looks at me and he goes, hey, Dr. Lerman, how are you? You know, I love the blue jeans you're wearing.
What?
You know, yeah, I love, you know, back then I had my hair spiked, and I'm thinking, and his mom looks at me and his two sisters, and they go, there he goes, showing off again. And I go, what do you mean? And they go, well, you know, he doesn't have eyes. And I go, that's true. So, but I figured you almost have told him what I was wearing. He goes, no, he can see. He hasn't told us why. Maybe he'll tell you. And so thus began this relationship with this incredible little boy, so who could see, and he'd show off occasionally. He wouldn't do it with everyone, but he'd
show off.
Are
you telling me this? First of all, what did he have false eyes put in there, or did they sew his eyelids shut? What
no,
did they do there?
That is no, they didn't even give him the false eyes, and they just let his eyelids just close down, and they packed him. They had some packing because he had a fluid coming out of it from the cancer. So they packed his eyes, you know, the sockets. And, but no. And, so I, you know, to make it's a beautiful story. It's a long story, but he eventually, when I sat there with him, his mom and sisters, for some reason at that point, went outside to get something. He goes, I've been waiting for you. He goes,
he was clairvoyant too.
Yes, and the way, and by that point, I'd had talked to so many patients, and I heard so many stories, but pretty much none like Matthew. I mean, he's so clear and dear to my heart, entrenched in my heart forever. And I said, Matthew, you know, I know these kind of stories, but where are you? Who's telling you, or how are you seeing me? And he goes, you know, he goes, the angels? And he goes, absolutely. He goes, my three angels, and he called them Raffi, Noe, and Gaby.
He had three angels telling him what you were wearing, or what he was looking at, basically.
Yeah, and basically
they were his eyes.
They were his eyes communicating with him. They were his essentially somewhat of an emotional stability and physical stability for him. They had been present in his life since he had lost his eyes and was going through these intense chemotherapy treatments. And they would show up, and he told me at that point they would show up every Friday during the chemo. They would take him. Many patients have told me this, that angels will, and when I talk about angels, most people describe them as a light being,
right.
Real bright light, in the shape of a human being, you know, androgynous and so forth. And so they would take him off to a place that they took from his mind, he said, a place that they knew he would love. So it's not like they give you a place they think you might like. They go in, they tailor it to everyone. And so they come into a very familiar place, and his familiar place was dolphins. He loved dolphins, and he always did. And so they took him swimming with the dolphins in this endless sea, you know, of dolphins. And he said he would ride them, and he said he'd ride them with other children that were on chemo at the same time with their angels.
What a remarkable story.
So he would tell me that pretty frequently, and he goes, well, you know, have you been out with angels lately? And I go, well, you know, I'm not having chemo anymore, but I've asked them to take me, and this time they took me, and I saw these my friends there. And I go, well, are some of these friends already passed? Have they passed? And what I was trying to get at was maybe I can pick up on some of these names of people that no one knows yet they have passed or about to pass, and that might be some kind of a proof that, you know, there is some clairvoyance and some foreknowledge, and that he is seeing things.
What happened to Matthew?
And so he tells me, he goes, oh, yeah, you know, Mike and, you know, I won't mention the names, but let's just say Mike and, you know, and Rudy and so forth and Sarah are here. But they are about to leave their body this afternoon. They are done.
He knew that, body. Too.
And so I said, do you mind if I check?
Check on
the
them.
Hospital.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he goes, absolutely, Dr. Lerner. He goes, I want you to notice. They want you to know. Because we don't want to keep we don't want to keep secrets from anybody. You know, heaven isn't about keeping secrets. Because it's just us. We're the limiting factor. We get the sense of we have to put our place our person in the right place, you know, with people who are passing or with people who have special powers or not that are better than us, but are connected to the other side. And you'll get the answers. I go, you can even get them from yourself. But, hey, go call. I call. They go, you know what? They're really, really sick. And so I went back to Matthew. You know what? They're really sick, Matthew, because they're going to die about 5:30.
I want to pick this up right from this spot. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Dr. John Lerma. And more of this incredible story with Matthew. There's so much to talk with you about, John, but I want to get the more of the story here.
Sure.
And so you went in to talk to the children who were near death's door. And we'll pick it up from there.
That's right. And they were. They had the doctors told me they had taken a turn for the worst. And, in fact, the names he had given me were the names of those children. So I went back to him, and this was somewhere early in the morning hours, and it's just across the street, so I just went over there to check in on to see if those kids were indeed alive or existed, for that matter. And so I went back to Matthew and says, Matthew, hey, they are there. You're right. They're pretty ill. And he goes, yeah, they'll probably be gone. Probably, I think the angels are telling me about 4:30 or so, and sure enough, I called around between 4 and 4:30, and of course, you know, I couldn't do anything for the rest of the day. I was just glued to wanting sure. to find out. And I actually went over there to the hospital and spent some time. I just wanted to be around those children and to comfort them as well. And sure enough, they died around 4:45. You know, not exactly what he said, but that's pretty close. And I went back to Matthew. They died very peacefully, I have to say. I didn't know him prior to that. They all had smiles on their faces, which is pretty common with children and some adults. So I went back to Matthew, and he goes, "They're here." And before I even said anything, he always knew it was me walking in, and maybe by that point he knew my footsteps, but he always knew. Of course, the angels were probably telling him. But he goes, "They're here, Dr. Lerma, they're here. They're happy, they're gone, and they're telling me that my time is coming pretty soon. However, I still have a couple of things to do, and in fact, it's my mom that has some things to do, my mom and my sisters." And so just sort of cutting it there, I mean, I was just totally amazed. I mean, the nurses that I had involved, also, we walked over there. There were a few people involved in trying to understand what was really going on, and also that it just wasn't me that was looking at this. You know, I wanted to turn around to somebody and pinch them and then pinch me and say, "Is this real? Is this happening?" And sure enough, and you know, and of course I'm telling the doctors out at MD Anderson this story the next day, and they go, oh, you know, that's nothing. That's just hallucinations. Well, what do you think about telepathy, or trying to get down to something they might even understand? And they go, no, it's just, it's all guesswork. They're hallucinating. That little boy always hallucinated. And I go, how can he hallucinate almost the exact time and the names of people that I didn't even know, and that they were going to die, all these three people, you know, these three children? And he goes, well, it's just guesswork. And so that's the kind of the doctors, you know, in the mainstream that I had to deal with. So I don't talk to them anymore. You know?
Yeah,
I have my own colleagues now, and I have, right now, what I'm more concerned in is, when it'll happen, they'll come around one day, but it's to try to get these stories out to the world and to comfort people not to be afraid of death. And so, you know, the story goes on with Matthew. It goes on and on, and so, again, Matthew is going, okay, Dr. Lerman, so what, I go, here's what's next. My mom, you know, she was abused by her husband or my dad, and went through so much other stuff, and that was just horrific. Her daughters were sexually abused by my dad. Then I, after she divorces my dad, she divorces him. He comes over, and apparently, in a scuffle, she killed him in protection for herself and protecting her children. Within the next month or so, he has cancer. And so it's like she can't win for losing. You know, it's like there's no God. And by this point, by the time I started speaking to her, she did tell me a lot of this, and you know, that Matthew told me, and she just totally had lost her faith. And Matthew, and here's something. Here is what Matthew told me that was that was really profound. And when I sat with Matthew alone, usually at night his mom would go home, and I sat with him and I said, "Matthew, why did you told me at the beginning you came to save your mom's soul." He goes, "Does that mean that you believe in reincarnation? I mean, were you already born and you came back? Or, I mean, what did you mean by that?" And he goes, "No." He goes, "Yes." He goes, "With God, there's anything is possible. For anybody to limit it, what he can do, you know, that's just enough said about those people. You know, there's no limitations. But before we're all born," he goes, "our conscience always exists. It's our bodies don't exist. You know, all of this creation doesn't exist. It's been formed for us to experience so that we can seek out this truth of sorts. And it's virtually eternal, but it's an incredible truth that you always want to keep searching, and there are many, many, many levels of love. Not just, okay, you go to heaven and you experience one love. It's like exuberant, exhilarant, ecstatic. Well, apparently there's other levels of exuberance, ecstatic, and, you know, exhilaration. And it never, never ends. It's an endless sea of love. And so that's exactly what he said. And he goes, so I knew what my mom's problems were going to be, and I knew that she would lose faith. And I wanted to make sure. I love my mom, you know. I guess not before that, but, you know, I love this soul. We love each other. We're all connected. And I go, you know, Matthew, you're talking in physics. And he goes, yeah, yeah, I know all that stuff. And I go, how do you know all that stuff? He goes, the angels talk about it. And they tell me, if you want to know anything, to ask, and they'll tell you what they think you should know. And so I asked him, and those were the questions I was saying. You know, what is reincarnation exist? And he goes, anything can, but here's the main thing. It's about the right now. My mom needs help. So does my dad. My dad, you know, we cannot look. You can't say that everything's interconnected except my dad, you know. And that's the big lesson we all are going to have to learn one day. We're just not there. We're only 6,000-7,000 years old as a civilization versus 14 billion years to get us here. You know, so we're moving pretty fast. He's saying we just have to have patience. Says, this is what I needed to do to help my mom. And so by coming here and offering my suffering, you know, for her, and that's something
this
I really
remarkable.
I have a heart. As a doctor, I still, you know, and I'm a Catholic and a Buddhist. My mom's Buddhist, my dad's Catholic, so I'm a Buddhist. But, you know, I have
Buddha cast. Huh?
And some people say, well, you're a New Age Buddhist. Ah, man, I'm just open. But, you know, I have a hard time with the suffering thing and the strength behind it. Pope John Paul II, friends of mine that were caring for him as hospice physicians, said that that's what he didn't want any pain medicine. He wanted to experience his suffering because of the strength behind it and the strength it would have to help the world. And so did Matthew. Matthew said the same thing. And I go, I don't understand that. Can't it be done another way? You know, he goes, Dr. Lerner, you don't understand. You're thinking suffering is ouch. It's hurting. He goes, my suffering is deeper than that. Think deeper. It's the thought that this soul of my mom may self-separate herself from the goal of being with God,
right,
being
right.
with me. That is suffering. I'm thinking about the future. You're still thinking like all of us, you know, that people say, oh, am I fearful of death? Yes, I am. But that really in reality is easily fixed. We can take care of that. But there's a greater suffering, and that's what that you take on. And he started teaching me a little bit about it. And there's a new book called God's Problem by Bart D. Ehrman that talks about suffering and trying to explain it, and that I really, really like. So he goes, okay, I'm still having a hard time with it, but fine. I'm going to let you suffer. And he goes, that's why the angels are here, to comfort my mind, to comfort that portion of me.
He wasn't scared at all, was he?
I'm sorry?
They weren't scared at all.
Gosh, no. Hell no. I mean, you know, that boy, he never had pain. Oh, my God, I'm telling you, I had to pinch myself every day. People from school would come, students, teachers, because he had cancer while he was there. And he had gone one time, let me just real quick, this story is awesome. He went one time to show and tell, where people take their, you know, little Susie takes her doll, or somebody else takes their fish. Well, he took his tumor
to show.
Yes, and was caused a real big issue there in the Houston Independent School District.
Was it a jar?
Attached to his head, you know. So they thought that the children could not handle that, the 6-7-year-olds. They thought they can't handle death. Well, let me tell you something. Children can handle death a lot better than adults. They don't fear it, you know, at least the ones I've been through. So he goes. They finally agree, and they said, fine, we're going to do it. It's his last wish. And it wasn't for him. He told me, Dr. Lerner, I'm doing it for the children and the adults, because then they're going to spread something. They're going to help others because of what they learn. So he shows up, and finally it's his turn, and of course the kids are looking at him. They go, "Wow, that poor thing." You know, he was emaciated, and he had.
You could tell he was very sickly.
Yeah, he was, and he was in a wheelchair, but he was jovial, smiling, beautiful, a little crooked smile, but just jovial, and that's what emanated from him. So as soon as you would start to feel sorry for him, it would be replaced. I have to say, and at least with everyone I spoke to, it would be replaced with this beautiful sense of hope and love. And that's what emanated, and everyone started, you know, after a while he starts talking, everyone's laughing, you think they're having a party. There's this little kid who's about to die in about a week that's in there, and he's telling him about his tumor, and everyone's raising their hands, okay, well, what does it feel like, and this and that, and they really didn't get into the pain portion. They immediately go, "Are you seeing angels?" And that's what the kids want to talk about. And, you know, Freud at one point did studies with Jung that kids are so close, they believe that there was a consciousness that was separate from our brain that wasn't formed by our, you know, by our neural nets, that actually came into us, that has always existed. So they tried to do this, you know, they did an experiment, asked kids, you know, "Hey, what are you thinking? What do you think about heaven?" And, you know, at least when they can talk. And some at 3 and at 4 were giving these profound answers, like, "Yeah, I feel like I'm stuck in my body, and I'm wondering when I can go back home." These are the answers that little kids were giving during the Freudian and Jungian studies. And so what they came down up with finally was saying, there's no way the brain is so young, there's no way it can come up with these profound statements. And so that's what, you know, that's when I started to realize, oh, my God, doing all these studies, that you really start proving that there, the consciousness does exist, has always existed. You know, all these beautiful texts out there, the Quran, the Torah, the Bible, name it. They're all talking about this. And now science is proving it. And here's a little boy that's proving it beyond proof. I mean, I am seeing it. My partners are seeing it. The medical students are seeing it. No one can deny that this little boy can see and see everything that you're wearing and tell you what you're thinking.
All the time.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
And pretty much. And, you know, sometimes he was real tired and he knew, I don't know, there were times that he didn't, and he would tell me the person wasn't worthy of it or something like that. I think they're, I don't know, maybe just he could read their heart.
John, what finally happened to him?
So here's this little boy that finally the angels tell him, okay, your mom, you know, you've suffered enough. Apparently there's a lot going on the quantum side, outside her brain and outside hers. So her spirit, his, are communicating, and that he would see that. And that she finally came to an understanding that in order for him to stop suffering, she was causing his suffering more by keeping him there, and which is what a lot of families do because of the lack of education.
Yeah.
And so, but this mother had the ability to see, and I think it's possible that everybody can. And she saw the angels and came to an understanding and finally agreed, along with the sisters, we've got to let him go. And he goes, "Dr. Lerma, it's done." He goes, "Can you come by Sunday?" And then Monday at 4, he goes, and I was sure. And I knew it was a very cryptic message. I came in at Sunday, and finally his mom, they're on this karaoke machine singing. And, of course, he's going to die the next day. No one knows that. But then, you know, they're partying down. They're partying down 24 hours before. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so she gets on the microphone and says, "I'm going to let him go, God." You know, and there were Christians. She goes, "Jesus Christ, I give him back to you. You know, I love you, and I'm sorry." And Matthew, as hard as it was, a tear flowed from his eye. And he really had no lacrimal glands anymore. And I'm thinking, where is that coming from?
Yeah.
And it was a real tear. It wasn't any kind of
water.
Liquid. Yeah, from the brain. No, this was a tear. And it's that one tear that's called epiphora, that people have right before they pass. It's one single tear. And so
caused by what? What causes that?
No one knows. I mean, I've never really been able to get an answer.
Is it an emotion?
It is. It's like, and it's just one from one eye. It's like I'm sure it's an emotion. But I think it's maybe that oneness. There is another story we can talk about later where one girl that's blind that ends up seeing at the end, she tells me a little bit about that tear, and Pope John Paul has something to do with that, but that one tear. But it's that tear with this other case that's at that whole, it's a sign of that one pureness. It's the final tear that is totally clean of everything.
I never knew about that.
And so it's a cleansing of sorts. I go up to him, I hug him, and he whispers, and he goes, "It's done." And so he goes, "Can you be by here tomorrow at 4? He goes, "I'll be gone by almost the same time as the last kid, by 4:30. And so
he knew his time. Amazing.
Yeah. And he goes, "Look, you can know your time." He goes, if you think you're ready ahead of time, he goes, "You can even die almost healthy." He told me that. And it just depends on where you're at on your connection, your lessons, and so forth. And he goes, "Dr. Lerma, you're going to learn more. And I'm going to be there with you. I'm going to guide you, and you're going to hear about me." And sure enough, he dies at 4:30 the next day.
Mm.
And from that point on, I've had people in the same room tell me that they hear dolphins, and as they're dying, I had a guy actually that was in that room that was a colonel. In fact, he told me some stuff about Roswell. He was connected with a Roswell thing. But he told me he saw this little boy named Matthew. And I've had other people tell me that have been through that room, and that he's saying hello. And I just sort of go with the flow, and I go, "Well, don't say hello," and my heart's just...
He's helping people now, isn't he?
Just bleeding. Oh, gosh, yes. And he goes, "That's what it's about." He goes, "It is about helping each other, letting our ego go. You know, some of us are still in the primordial state. Some of us are still in the Neanderthal thinkers, and we know who those are. And then there's some that are higher. But it's if you're at the front of the line, you know," he told me this once. He goes, "Remember, if you're in the front of the line, the front of the line will be the last, or however it goes, and the last will be first." He goes, "But do you know what that means more?" He goes, "But no one." He's not saying that the last person won't get in. Everybody gets in because everybody needs to help.
I like that line. I'll be back. John, you were telling me about a person who witnessed Roswell. Tell me about that. A colonel?
That's correct. A lieutenant colonel, I suspect that. I suspect he was higher. mainly, he showed up from Walter Reed Hospital and just a few years ago. And to MD Anderson, he had a very, very rare form of cancer in his bones and had spread everywhere. They thought it was radiation-induced. He was a particle physicist and worked for the research portion of the Army. And when he showed up to MD Anderson, most people thought that was, first of all, that was very interesting because we rarely get any military people. They usually stay at Walter Reed, and then they have great care there. For some reason, he decided to come over to Houston and get treated there. You know, they do a lot of incredible research and have some medicines that other people don't have. But, of course, it failed, and this gentleman who's been in the military, you know, he's a lifer, very stoic, just an old, cantankerous old man, you know, finally decides, "Okay, I just want to give this up. Let me go into hospice." So he shows up essentially at our doorsteps, and I met him out there in the ambulance with his wife, and I just, again, saw this emaciated gentleman and just pale, not wanting to die, wanting to live. And here's a gentleman who I found out later who was in charge of some incredible, advanced aerial technology. And you know, and I can't prove a lot of this, but because of the way things happened and what I saw in terms of the papers from the government and his appointments and that he did work at these places, I put one and one together. And with a fixed physics background myself, I knew more than likely this man worked at very top secret places. And also the fact that there was a few generals coming over, and he had a guard outside at times. And and so that's when I started wondering, okay, I think this guy's somebody. And so there was a point. There was one time when one of the generals comes up and he goes, you know, Doctor, we'll deny anything.
And what year was this, John?
This was, what are we to do? This is probably about 2001, and not too long ago. You know, I think during the Bush administration. And so,
it wasn't Philip Corso, was it?
No, not at all. No, it was not him.
Not that you could tell me, but
yeah. And no, but it wasn't him. And no, I'd never heard of this gentleman before. But you know, for the book purposes, his name was Marsh. You know, Colonel Bradfield. You know, I just came up with that name. I didn't want to give the right his true name. And but you know, one of the when he finally came in, and you know, there were some military men there and some men just dressed like in black, you know, black suits. And so you start sort of, you know, hanging around Whitley, you know, I've heard about all these.
You get used to that.
And I'm thinking, wow, is this what Whitley's talking about? And so I said, oh, well, whatever. So I'm just going to take care of him the way I take care of everyone. And he felt immediately, he tried being really tough on me immediately. And I just said, look, you know you have cancer. You know, you're probably the kind that doesn't like to be BS'd. I'm just going to come down and tell you, this is what I think you have left, and I'm here to help you. And if you're fearful of anything, we'll talk about that, you know, without people here. And sure enough, even this man was fearful. Just like every human, how am I going to die? Am I going to suffocate? How much pain am I going to have? And I quickly comforted him with the facts that I was able to show him, you know, and finally prove to him with the first medicines that all of that made him feel comfortable. And it was at that point that we really developed this trust, and he wanted to tell me something. You know, after he found out that, you know, I sit down with my patients. I just don't go in there. You know, I have 20 or 30 at one point, at sometimes just 10. So I spend all day with them.
Sure.
And, especially a lot of them come in, George, with no families, even though they have families. They're just so separated, and it's so sad.
They're lonely.
Yeah, and, you know, so we become their family. And they died peacefully, I have to say. So so this man just had his wife, and that was pretty much it, and the rest of the military people that would come visit him. And I don't think they were visiting him after a while just because they were his friends. I think they were observing his mental status, his cognitive functioning, what he was able to communicate, because I would walk in and I say, okay, what I heard them saying is that one of them, in fact, was military, in the medical, had the medical insignia on it. So he may have been a doctor. And telling him, hey, you know, what's, you know, date, time, you know, he's trying to check his orientation. And do you remember this day? Do you remember that? And he could not remember a lot of it. However, when they left, they pulled me out. One of them says, remember, he has top secret status. Anything that's said, you've got to keep it to yourself, or let us know what he told you if you think it's of national security. And I said, fine, no problem. And so when I went back into the room, and finally the even the guard would leave at times because they knew he was getting worse. He'd come back and he'd tell me, oh, I was just acting, those assholes. But at any rate, so it was so funny. And so he thus began the story. He was just telling me, you know, I'm really tired of that, of that very, very strict type of life. And no human should have to live like that. He goes, if people think that all these you know, the conspiracies, and it's really cool to be one of these guys and know about the UFOs, and it's not. He goes, it's horrific. It's like the mafia. He goes, they'll kill you. He goes, if they know that you're saying things, and they get away with it. No one's ever going to go to jail. And so he goes, look, I'm going to tell you some stuff, but I'm only going to tell you enough where you won't get in trouble. And and he told me a bit more, and I found out a bit more after he died through his wife. And he initially told me that he was a friend of Mag Brazel's. And
who was the rancher that these objects apparently landed on his ranch?
That's absolutely right. In 1947.
Yep, July 47.
Somewhere around in, you know, July 4th or something like that. And the reason he said he had gone back, you know, he wanted to go visit his mom and dad. And during that period of time, he had leave. And there had been a storm. And he said that, that it was not uncommon for the military and a lot of the experimental craft at that point, or whatever the, you know, missiles that they were working on, were being worked out of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, not so much in the desert as of yet. And so they were working on getting things together there to start doing research projects, but everything ended up moving towards Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And I go, well, why is that? He goes, well, that's where we had all our scientists, all the necessary equipment needed to back engineer and so forth. And I go, by back engineer, you mean that you all have found things from other countries that you don't know how they work? And he goes, part of it. And he goes, ask me more. And he goes from other worlds. And he goes, possibly. And he goes, okay. And he goes, but a lot of it came from the Nazis. He goes, initially, a lot of it came from the Nazis. And it was under... This is where I started really researching, and I know a little bit more about it now. And it was Project Paperclip, and I know a lot of people out there. He goes, this is what happened. And the United States and Russia were supposed to have split the knowledge equally. But the Nazis were already, scientists, he said, were already calling them over a year in advance, connecting with them. With the United States,
they knew they wanted.
Yes, they knew. Yeah, they knew the war was ending. But had they stayed and gone, they knew it was either going to be Russia or United States. Okay, Russia. The Russians were going to kill them all. They were going to sacrifice them because of all the Russians that died, the millions and millions that Hitler killed, and they blamed the scientists a lot. So, and they did kill a lot of the scientists. So the United States started to make that deal, and the big part of Project Paperclip was to get these scientists out. And it wasn't just, he told me, Dr. Lerman, it's not just about aerial phenomena. It wasn't just about the Honeyboo, the first saucer-shaped craft that was made under the Hitler regime. He goes, it's about biology, advanced biological things. People tend to forget that it's not just about the UFOs. It's like, what else was he doing? He goes, what else were the Japanese doing with biology besides cloning, besides breaking down the DNA? They wanted to know the answer they wanted power, just like everyone else in probably the United States now. And they wanted that ultimate power, and they knew that the quantum side existed at that point. And even Einstein refused to believe that the quantum side existed. That's why he never could prove or get together the unified field theory, which I think today somebody out of, I guess in Europe, has finally put it together, supposedly.
Well, did you believe this, Lieutenant Colonel John, at this point?
I believed parts of it. And I believe because... when I was speaking to Whitley was telling me other things. Be real careful, John, because these guys, even in their deathbed, will do, I mean, they are dedicated to the cause.
For disinformation.
Absolutely. And he knew, and he goes, well, does he know you're writing a book? And he goes, absolutely. He goes, gosh, what a perfect way to continue the disinformation, you know?
Yeah.
And he goes, so... go ahead, you know, just listen to him and put it together and we'll see. So I think this is what he's telling me. And I, at that point, it all makes sense. Okay. I think everybody knows that part. That, you know, Project Paperclip, the Nazis, they went to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. You know, you can find that anywhere.
Did he ever talk about little aliens, occupants, anything like that?
He told me, he goes, I'll never admit to that to you, Dr. Lerma. And he goes, however, not only was there a second crash, he goes, but there were more flying objects that night that got away or that weren't involved in that crash.
Right.
And in fact, you know, this thing started, people saying 2 weeks before, what was that guy's name?
Kenneth Arnold.
Right. That he said that he saw the original craft and up in
Near Mount Rainier.
Yes. But he told me that they already had, and I tend to believe this because I was looking and there are some reports that people had been seeing this prior to that, probably starting maybe that year, earlier that year. And it wasn't Kenneth Arnold. Just saying Kenneth Arnold wasn't the first one. There were already a lot of reports from people because they started flying these things. Almost 18 months after they transferred the scientist over, they brought all the information. They were working intensely on gravitational, anti-gravity. You know, they were working on missiles, just a lot of other stuff. But mainly Hitler wanted that anti-gravity. You know, he wanted that spacecraft that could beat anything, even to the end. And he was really, he said he was really even killing some of these scientists, you know, to get it out. And boy, did they get a lot out, but they weren't able to accomplish it. And what they did accomplish didn't work because of the high energy exuded from these aerial, you know, these aerial spacecraft, the electromagnetism. If you put a gun underneath, because back then that's what they had, the guns with the 50 caliber bullets or whatever, the heat sparked by the, you know, by these craft would cause the bullets to, you know, to go off. And so it wasn't going to do anything. So he says that's what the Foo Fighters were. The Foo Fighters were these, and they became basically drones. Some of them were manned, but most of them weren't. And it was just to get the pilots just sort of their mind off of, you know, or at least for that moment, think that what's going on here? What are these things, you know? And meanwhile, maybe they'd be shot down by a Nazi. So it was just to distract them more than anything. No.
Man, you've seen it all, John.
So we know, but we know all this stuff, this part. I said, well, I know this. You know, Mr. Marsh, I go, Colonel Marsh, I go, I know this. I mean, we've heard these Foo Fighter stuff. I go, tell me something that I don't know. And he goes, well, I guess what people don't want to believe is that the Nazis had a lot to do with it. But where, and I go, yes, but where did they get it? My question is, did they just develop it on their own? Was there never any aliens? And that was part of the disinformation campaign? Or was there? And he goes, that's the part I can never tell you. I will die to my grave with that. And he goes, well, I think you told me enough. And I think that's telling me. And he goes, but I will tell you this. There were bodies found at that second site, just with the way they said it. I know Whitley has spoken about it. You know, I've talked to one other person from Roswell, a family also who died on my service, just a husband and wife team, that told that their lives were threatened. There was people, they knew people, very close friends of theirs that did see these people, these aliens. Maybe they were drones. Who knows what they were, but they weren't human. And they certainly had the big eyes, just like what everyone says, the small arms. And so he's telling me, look, Dr. Lerner, the bottom line is there is incredible technology. And the technology is so far advanced right now that the Star Trek thing is nothing. If you look at Star Trek, we're way beyond that now. And what's sad about it is that the government is going to start will only release these things slowly, because this is what they're holding on to maintain our superiority. They're using antimatter now, that these new super colliders, they're stockpiling antimatter. He goes, that's the big thing. You know, we don't want nuclear weapons. I mean, of course, the terrorists do, because they can't do the antimatter thing. That takes a lot of money, and it's very obvious when you're putting one together. But you remember that super collider here in Texas that they were working
yes,
on?
Yes, absolutely.
Just about finished. Okay, and in fact, it's there still. I took care. It's just incredible. I mean, at MD Anderson, you got to remember, people from all over the place come there because it's the number one cancer institute in the world. They do the greatest research, and people are looking for the cure. So you get people from everywhere: Muslims, Buddhists, kings, queens, the rank and file. And so I think Colonel Marsh was no exception. And and I've had many other people that come from all over the world. So, and because I was one of the few palliative doctors, I would see thousands of people a year die. And there was probably only two or three of us. So we would see just about everyone that would die, that would come in there and they would die, at least briefly talk to them and get to know them. And this is how I got to know a lot of these people. And that's when I started saying, God, what, just in itself, there is a book on confession. On people's lives, what they've lived. You know, Jews, I've had so many Jews, oh my God, how horrible, George, that told me that they were under the experiments, the genetic experiments of Dr. Mengele, without any anesthesia, putting stuff up their, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, from those people to I had another girl that was Palestinian, who would play around, you know, with Hamas and everybody, part of the family was killed. And there was the plutonium case shells that her doctor told me from over there that are being used today.
It's called depleted uranium. John, we're going to come right back. We're at the top of the hour. Next up, phone calls with you, plus the key question, what you think is on the other side. John, you have stood by people who have passed to the other side. Have you come up with your own conclusions, your own personal conclusions now, what you think is over there?
There, in my heart and in my very essence, and now that I've reconciled my scientific mind with my human essence, spiritual essence, there is something extremely loving, non-condemning, non-judgmental, something so incredible that it makes people literally smile at the end of their life, and a smile that can't be taken off. And usually when someone dies, immediately the muscles will relax, but those muscles don't relax. And it's so profound. I mean, after, 15,000 plus patients, you see 80% of them doing this, the pattern continues. Mm-hmm. There's something there. I mean, scientifically, that's, you know, in order to have something scientifically proven, you have to have a consistent pattern and replication, and it's being replicated. It transcends cultures, races, you know, religion, everything. And what we have in common, we're human. We're human beings living in a tough world, and they're seeing something which that's the God I believe in. Is that the God, an incredible loving person that knows that we've all had a tough life in this world and that we deserve to have something that we go back to that you can smile to at the end of your life and beyond that, of course. And it just doesn't stop there. And there's still a lot of mystery that's left, but all in all, it's really not. It's all about we're learning and we're seeking. We're learning and seeking and moving forward. And to answer the questions of who are we, where do we come from, where are we going, and what are we supposed to do. And all the people that die, they know the answers to those questions at the very end.
Well said. Let's go to the phones. Ready? Let's go to Pennsylvania. Donna, first-time caller. Hi, Donna.
Hi. Really quick story.
Sure.
My mother battled cancer, and she was one of the most positive people I ever knew. And she had a living will, but on the day that she passed away, they did have her on a lot of morphine to help with what he was talking about. And she couldn't focus on any of us. And then all of a sudden, she focused right on my father, and she grabbed his hand and smiled and said, he said, it's time. And then she closed her eyes and passed on.
Oh, wow. And there you go, George.
Yeah. Thanks, Donna. Love that story.
Donna, that's awesome. And, you know, still my heart goes with you and your father and everybody. But that's beautiful. She exists, and she's still there for you.
Randy in Dayton, Ohio, on the wild card line. You're on with Dr. John Lerma.
Hey, George.
Hey, Randy.
Dr. Lerma.
Moondog. I know the voice now.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Nighthawk, how are you?
I know that name, yes.
Doctor, I sent you an email today. I'm Randy. I told you I was hoping I'd get to talk to you about
I'm glad you got in.
Thank
you.
See, Randy, prayers do come true, don't they?
Oh, yes, they sure do. Absolutely. I live it. I'm a daily testament of it every day. First of all, the Matthew, that's such an amazing story.
Thank you. Thank you.
In 1985, my mother passed away. I was told that the night before she passed, she had an operation, that a friend of hers that had passed years ago had sat at the end of her bed and said she had come to take her home.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then my wife's father, Ralph, he was in hospice here in Dayton. Had a childhood friend apparently come to his room and visit him.
Wow.
The next day, my father-in-law's brother come to the room to visit him, and he had told him about his friend. And my father-in-law did not know that his friend had passed away months before. He would tell us that, you know, he would see people outside his window walking, and they did have him on morphine, Dilaudid, and all the
right
drugs to help him and everything. And
right.
I read that the post today for tonight's show, and I had to call.
Well, that's an awesome story. George, you know, that happens, and that happens a lot of times where people are seeing, as they're passing, they've seen someone, and that always went against the research project, okay? If they're going to see somebody, they've got to be dead. They've got to be deceased loved ones. So occasionally someone would pop up, the family goes, oh, no, they're still alive. And I go, gosh, are you sure? Let's look up. How long was it that you saw this person? Well, it's been a month or so. It always turned out, George, they were deceased. And the ill person also didn't know, but was the one that knew. So that's for the family and for myself, those people, it was entrenched. I mean, it is just carved in their heart that there is another side, especially with that proof.
Great. Thanks, Moondog.
Hey, Dr. Lerma.
Beautiful story, dude. That's awesome, man. I love it.
Yeah, Dr. Lerma?
Yes, sir.
The one I was telling you about, my mother, a friend of hers that had passed years ago, an old friend of hers from her childhood. The other story was that when my grandmother had passed,
yes,
she had sat on the same woman's end of her bed and told her she had come to take her home also.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go on.
I truly believe it. And Dr. Lerma, I live right across the street from Wright Pat.
too close for comfort, Randy.
That's right.
Thanks, Randy.
You know what? And these are the stories that we've heard, George, even before we started researching them from our grandparents and grandparents, that, hey, you know, Papa saw somebody. The Egyptians, way back when, everyone's been seeing these things. Finally, we're finally looking into it and saying, what is it that's doing? And maybe before we talk, I can just let you know what we found out on these new MRIs.
Sure. I'd love to hear this.
We're going to hear these stories over and over, and I just wish people would talk more about that. You know what, at church, I wish when I went in church that people, our priests would talk about this. You know, they don't even want to talk about death.
You know,
let's talk about, hey, you know, today we lost somebody in our parish, and guess what? This is it.
Well, in the old days, they used to do it in Latin. I couldn't understand when I was a kid what the heck they were talking about.
You're so funny. That's true. Anyway, go ahead.
All right, next up, let's go to Joe in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Joe.
Hey, George, thanks.
Sure thing.
Hey, Joe.
Hi, Doc. You know, George has these people that I called my doom and gloomers on that just make my blood boil, but here you come talking about death, and all I can do is shake my head and go, what a beautiful show. You know, quick story. My father back in 98 was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in February and given 2 months to live.
Wow.
He was stubborn. He wasn't ready to go. And in December, a week and a half before he passed away, a bunch of nuns came over to visit him, and one young novice walked up to him and said, well, Mr. Joe, how are you doing? And he said, well, do you know what the monkey said when he caught his tail under the lawnmower? She goes, no, what did the monkey say? And he said, it won't be long.
Gotta remember that one.
How much longer was it that, you know, did he pass after that?
About 2 weeks.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, Joe, I'm here in San Antonio with you, you know. Hey, I'm gone.
You're not related to the late pharmacist, are you?
Cousins. Yes, I am.
Really? I grew up in that neighborhood, and that man was a giant in the neighborhood. If he couldn't make it back to Dr. JJ, all he had to do was walk up to that counter, and he knew exactly what you needed.
You know, and it just seems to be medicines in our family, and that they had actually a beautiful story too when he died. But I love that story, Joe, and thank you for calling. It means a lot to me and for everyone listening, all the people. And I just want to say, George has an incredible show. I love your show, George, and I got to meet George at a conference for the first time.
Yeah,
and even though we've been talking, I just got to tell everybody. He's real. He's the real thing. And is it Tom?
Tom Danheiser, sure thing.
Just a wonderful guy. I mean, George dresses very nice, by the way, guys.
Yeah, that time.
He's Mr. Model. But he is so nice and so funny. And the selfless person you'll ever meet, he doesn't think about himself, but everyone else. I just want to tell you that, George. And thank you. I really feel very comfortable with you when we talk. It just flows the way God would want it. Thank
Shucks,
you.
John, I'm blushing. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, will go east of the Rockies. Dr. Resnick. Hey, Doc.
Hey,
what's going on up there?
George, first of all, it's Dr. Resnick in Pittsburgh, inventor of stealth technology.
Yes.
I want to personally and nationally and worldwide apologize to you for a nasty email that I sent to you some time ago.
So, well, you don't have to apologize, but that's okay.
Oh, yes, I do. Yes, I do. I was ignorant of the fact that you are a veteran, Navy decorated veteran. Now, I'm apologizing. Dr. Resnick, Joseph A. Resnick, inventor of stealth technology, hereby apologize.
Accepted.
And you know what? That's a beautiful thing when we can do that and accept it. It brings us all together. That's
Dr. John,
concept. Yeah.
Reason for my call tonight. You know, mm-hmm. I've been listening since 2:30 this morning. I've got to put dogs out. I live out here in Bourne Township, protected lab. I do this work for the military, do all this stuff. Anyhow.
Wow. Yeah.
You have enlightened me tonight. You uh-huh. have showed me exposed things to me that I had never considered.
Yeah.
I didn't consider these things. When uh-huh. you talked about the little girl, you know, and
uh-huh.
you know what? Hey, George, good show.
Thanks, Doc.
All right.
Listen,
George, please accept this apology for me.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're an awesome guy. You know, you're I have to just say you're working on your with a brain that is open to God, and that's where we're all heading. And you're an incredible person. If everybody could do that, the world would be different.
Let's go to Houston, Texas. Linda, it's your turn. Hi.
Gee, what a great show tonight.
It is inspiring, I'll tell you that.
Oh, always inspiring. I love all your shows, but this one's really fabulous. Just
hi,
before
Linda.
I ask a question. Hi, how are you, darling?
Fine, baby.
Hi, baby.
I want to tell you a quick story that a good friend of mine, this little boy, had leukemia. And on his last trip to the hospital, he told his mother in the car that he would not be coming home with her this time, that the angels had told him that he was going with them. And, of course, she didn't want to buy it, and she was crying and carrying on. Well, obviously, when they got to the hospital, she finally told him it was okay to go with the angels, and he did not go home with her. That just tore me up that a six-year-old would know that. But my question is, do very many of the patients ever talk about reincarnation? And I'm going to take this offline so I can go in and sit with my mother and listen to your answer because she says hello, too.
Okay, and we're on a delay, so you'll have time. Go ahead, Jen.
You know, I do get a lot of, you know, that question. That's why I mentioned a little about what Matthew mentioned, you know, that I was coming here to help my mom. And, you know, they do, but it's not what you would think that you're hearing, you know, an extensive response. They say, all they say, Linda, is that it's possible. However, if you knew the possibilities, the infinite possibilities of what we have brothers and sisters all over this universe and other universes. When you look at, like one was telling me, John, you got to just look at God, and you know, when they talk eternal, we're talking eternal, you know, and then you look at that new spectrum of our universe, that new picture they've taken it. Well, you look at that universe, and then you look beyond that. You look at the darkness. Well, that just keeps going and going and going. And what these people tell me when I ask them that, says, Dr. Lerma, you know what's behind all that? There's another Big Bang going on. And there's another Big Bang and another type of a different Big Bang. And there's life just everywhere. And our goal is to eventually connect. We're trying to learn to connect with each other here first and to try, at least just try. As long as we have the ego, we're never going to get it right. And hopefully eventually that'll go away. But we're eventually going to learn to move from planet to planet. And apparently we have technology like that. And eventually to other universes or dimensions, however you want to look at it. But like Einstein said, it'll be done. A lot of it won't be done with crafts. It won't be done with incredible technology, but it will be done when man realizes that he has the power within himself to do that. And so that's what matters. It's about what you do today.
By the way, that was Dr. Joe Resnick, who did develop stealth technology. He used to work with Westinghouse and then did some work with NASA. And
wow.
That's amazing.
That's, that's incredible. My God. I know. I was like going, how incredible is that?
Yeah, he jumped all over me a few years ago, but I guess, you know, there he is. A bigger man knows how to apologize, huh?
It is. And see, there's miraculous things going on. I'm telling you, when you just start talking about beautiful things, connections, and love, it brings the best out of people.
John Lerma, where do you get the book, Learning from the Light?
You know, most people tend to just get it off Amazon.com.
Simply sit home, just sit on your computer, do it.
Yeah, but it is.
A lot of people like going to bookstores, too.
Yeah, and if it is, it's going to be, you know, Barnes & Noble's, and what are the major book chains.
Oh, they're everywhere.
And you know, you all have, I always tell everybody, look, here's the bottom line. I'm doing this. The money that I make on any of this, I use to help to further my hospice, care for people who can't afford it, and just to educate and to fly myself to places to talk, but also to give books to people who can't afford it. So, you know, all truthfully, you know, people, I got to trust people, but I tell people, whoever can't afford a book, please email me and I'll send you one. these messages are that important. I have been entrusted by my patients who they gave selflessly as they were dying for all of y'all and for myself and everyone else. And I don't want to keep, this is not about the money. This is, I need to get these things out. And if people can't afford it, please just let me know and I'll send you one home.
Good for you, John. You ready for some more final calls?
Sure, please.
We'll do that when we come right back with our special guest tonight, Dr. John Lerma. If you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. Now get up to the new website. You're going to love it once you learn where everything is, because even I am learning where everything is. But it's very simple to use. And keep your suggestions coming to Lex, by the way, because we're still tweaking it. Some people can't find, for example, how to find Fast Blast. So just keep doing that, and we're going to massage that a little bit. But it's very user-friendly. And once you get used to it, you'll realize how simple life really is. I'll be back in a moment. We'll take final phone calls with Dr. John Lerma on Coast to Coast AM. Into final calls now with John Lerma. John, before we take the calls, you talk a lot about ego as well. What's its role in all of this?
Well, the ego's role, it is, you got to go to the beginning of our life. It's necessary. And, of course, the churches like to view it as our sinful nature. And then there's a higher self or identity that's our non-sinful nature, the God, the divine person. But here's the deal, man. It's all part of bringing us together, keeping us alive at all costs. That's the prime directive, is to keep us alive. So that's the ego's prime directive initially. And why? Because look, what do little kids do? Little babies do? They cry, me. Before they even say me. And they're crying when they're hungry. They're crying when they need to be changed. They're crying when they need something. Because they can't communicate it. That's the ego. The ego is, and that's where it starts to develop its selfish nature. Initially, it's needed. It's needed to survive. Now, here's the thing. Depending on parental guidance, and that's why it's real important. I know it's tough in this world, especially right now with the economy and all that, to spend time with the children, but it's really important to try to teach your kids, especially in school districts, respect and to understand what their ego is. I've been teaching my kids that, and since I've done that, they understand that they look. I tell them, okay, what was that you just did? Is that ego or is that your quantum side? And they actually say, is that my Newtonian brain or my quantum brain? No, that's my ego, Dad. Well, is that good, what you just did? And he goes, no. Do you have a choice? He goes, yes, I have a choice from my higher awareness, which, and I go, which is what? Connected to the quantum field, which is God. And that's where the choice goes into the law of superposition, the quantum law of infinite possibilities. And the ego is very limited. It's very self-defeating. It's clever. It's unintelligent. But it always, and it never wants to die. But yet, the irony to it, it ends up killing itself. It stabs itself in the back. And so, the people, it's real easy. It's the people who are backstabbing you. You know what the ego isn't? The gentleman that called and asked you for forgiveness? That was so anti-ego. That was higher awareness.
Yeah, it was.
That was ego depleted. That was beautiful, that to me, it touched me, and it was touching. It was a very touching moment for me, because it shows me that we do have the ability. And so that really, all in all, that's the easy way of looking at the ego. Does it ever go away? No. But as we get older and we form our identity, George, hopefully we're being taught that the ego, okay, it had its time. Now we need to minimize it. We need to be aware of its dark ways or its selfish ways, and we need to move into a position of self-love, of believing in yourself, having a lot of dignity, which the ego doesn't. Ego always wants to put you down and put everyone else down, and it just wants to think of itself. So, and eventually starting to ask questions of you know, the four questions. Who am I? Where do I come from? Where am I going? Ego doesn't want you to ask those questions because it leads you where? Into the domains of the brain that leads you into in the infinite love.
Yes. The spirituality end of you.
And so, yes, the ego doesn't. So that's the real battle. That is the real battle. And so I think a lot of times I think, George, when we're talking, as a Christian, I go to church and I hear this, where two or more are gathered or the two or more, you know, there I am in the midst. You know, it's the reconciliation of those two. I'm saying, what if no one was in the world? Then does that parable go away? I really believe the two starts within. It's reconciliation of your ego and your higher awareness. It's saying, you know what? It is. It helped me live. It played its purpose. And now I need to. I'm mature now. I need to take control of it and thank it for what it did. But now move forward with it. And, acknowledge what it did, and that's it. But not be angry at it.
All right, let's move on.
Yeah, so that's what it is. We could go on for it in that, but that's just a beautiful thing.
San Antonio, Texas. Ever been there, John? Kidding.
Second one. No, kidding. That's cool. Who do we got?
Cheryl. She's got you. Hi, Cheryl.
Good morning, Mr. Norrie and Dr. Johnny.
Yes,
I am from San Antonio. Hi, I am a hospice nurse, and I have to tell you, I have been privileged to have been taught by Dr. Lerma. In fact, he is responsible for bringing me over to the hospice side and for helping me to understand. The call that you got earlier about the apology, it's so incredible, and Dr. Lerma will verify this, the God incident. This is one of the things that he really is stressing, and he talks about a lot in his book, is how we need to get our relationships right. And, if we need to go for an apology, we need to do that. You know, if we need to forgive someone else, we need to forgive them. But here it is, you know, a huge call that you got, talking about the very thing that Dr. Lerma stresses. And the things that he talks about, these stories that he tells you, these things go on every day in his life, and a lot of people who work in the hospice field see these things as well, and you will find very few people in the medical field who have not experienced, if nothing else, the feeling of the spirit as it's leaving. It's pretty incredible.
That's right. Cheryl, you're awesome, and she is so awesome. She has done such a great job, and since she's been there, more she calls me every time. Guess what? Guess what? I saw this, and I heard you were right, and I'm going. Look, it's not that I'm right. I just, you know, I'm willing to talk about it and put it out in a book. And many doctors are scared of doing that, but people now, I get a lot of calls, George, and a lot of emails from a lot of other hospices now. They feel much more comfortable to discuss it.
Absolutely.
Because I will tell you, George, even hospices, they're being watched very closely about how they communicate the spiritual side of it. And that's why one day I want to be able to have a nonprofit hospice where, you know, people can be themselves. Let's just try to get along and not be micromanaged. It is people at the very end just need to be comforted and loved. And Cheryl understands that. But thank you, Cheryl. You're so awesome.
Next up, we go to Angela in Paris on the international line. Is that where you are, Angela?
Yes, I am. Hello, George.
Hi.
Hello, doctor.
Hi, Angela. How are you?
I'm very well. It's a great show. Speaking of death and dying, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was one of my heroes.
Yes.
She was a South American physician.
One of the best.
One of the best, yes. And, well, I just wanted to tell a very short story. My father, a sergeant, and his lieutenant were both shot and killed in the line of their duty by one with a persecution complex who died in prison. I was a young child. But my father's greater spirit has been with me to this very day.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's.
How do you feel him? I mean, you feel him around you?
Well, yes, he's inside of me, and the high intelligence and the best parts of him are still alive within me, working in the world, in the light.
Yeah. I hear you. You know, I a lot of my patients who have lost, you know, especially spouses married over 40 plus years have always told me that they, other than feeling him inside, they actually feel a warmth around them, a protective layer, and they know when they're gone and they know when they come. My dad, I felt the same thing, and I knew the day he left. I'm starting to interview a lot of the survivors now, and I want to write a book about that. Not so much about the dying patients, but the survivors and the visions they're having, because that's occurring equally as often as it is to the dying patients, especially to the spouses. And it usually occurs within the first 40 days. You know, I hear 4 weeks, you know, for me, just real quick, 4 weeks is usually when they see the first, it's an average, but 4 weeks when they see their first entity. And if they're in the hospital, usually at the doorway, and they have to invite them in. They invite them in, and they start to review the life and in a very, very comforting way. If there's anything dark, it's the person themselves that's bringing it on from their guilt. But the other side does whatever it needs to do to take that away. And then the last 3 days of life, usually it's all done, and there are 20, 30, 40 angels in the room, family. It's a joyful occasion. And hopefully those last 3 days, everyone will come, the family that are the survivors will come to an understanding that they need to let them go. I have seen people who are ready to die those last 3 days, and family comes out of the woodwork and says, no, I'm not ready to let them go. And they will hang on so that person lets them go. And they do it because they know if they don't do that and they die, the person will feel guilty later on in life, and they don't want to leave.
That's
that person.
Exactly right.
So you got to let them go, John. And that's the biggest and hardest, really the biggest obstacle in hospice is my families. The families, and that's why I want to educate more and more people. This closure's got to be given.
West of the Rockies, Chico, California, we go. Hi, Sue. Go ahead.
Hello, Dr. Larimore. I have a beautiful story to tell you. I had a very wonderful friend who, believe it or not, in life was a mafia hitman turned Christian. And his housekeeper called me one day and said, Sue, George is gone. And would you believe that he is still with me in spirit and I can feel him around me? I happen to be a blind person, and I have one question.
Wow.
What do you feel when you go, and what do you feel on the other side, sir? And I have never seen all of my life, and I lost my vision due to glaucoma later, what little I had.
How long have you been blind now?
All my life.
All your life?
Yes, and I lost what little light perception I had due to glaucoma.
Okay, so you really don't have an idea of true shapes of people and so forth, or what they
right.
really look like? Okay.
Right.
That's incredible, George, because I wanted to talk about that part of the research in the blind person.
Yeah.
I want to be in the book.
To be in the book.
I will write, and we need to talk and email each other. But
I don't have a computer.
Okay.
Well, I tell you what, I'm going to put you on hold. Would you give Jason your phone number, and we'll give it to John?
Yeah, and please put your magazine in an accessible format. It is not for us. Your After Dark magazine is only for the sighted.
No, you're right about that.
And please do it.
You're right. Okay, I'm going to put you on hold, okay?
Okay.
And Jason, get her phone number, and you give it to John right after the show. Next up, let us go to Los Angeles, where Linda is waiting. Hi, Linda.
Hey, George. This show just keeps getting better and better.
Hi, Linda. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. You know, I don't usually get a chance to stay up this late, but for whatever reason, I'm up. And I was listening, and so many things that you've said in the show have validated my own experience when my mom passed away. And I just want to tell you real quickly, she had multiple brain tumors, and we had gone to see her in the hospital. And she was telling me about this beautiful movie star that came to see her that was dressed in this, you know, gorgeous dress with gold thread. And you know, I just kind of chalked it up to maybe just a hallucination or
right.
something. And then when we got her home, the night before she died, she was telling me that people were coming to take her on a trip. And mm-hmm. I actually had to get, not angry with her, but I had to say, well, what are you waiting for? You know, go already. And I, of course, I didn't know she was going to die that night. But that just, you know, when I first started hearing the show and you were talking about the little boy and the angels, mm-hmm. it kind of validated what I experienced. And then when you started talking just recently about, you know, seeing things and people in the room, mm-hmm. it's like it validated everything that I had experienced.
Your mom did it exactly as most people do. Some say, I'm taking a trip. I want to go home. And so, but the family usually confuses that to the real home, you know, their home, their earthly home.
Right. Uh-huh.
And so they're fighting that, doctor, we need to get them home. And I'm going, patient's hardly breathing. We can't get them home. That's not the home we're talking about. And it took me a while to understand that, but that's what they talk about. I want to take the train. Plane, the train, whatever. And in fact, the train will have people that have just been, that just died in that arena, in that vicinity. So it's really interesting because they'll tell me, oh, doctor, one of them said, no, I'm not ready. And he saw the train leave with certain people that were in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, look, there was that lady from that room over there and that man. And I go, well, they haven't told me they died. And I stepped out and the nurses said, oh, doctor, I just want to inform you that these people just died. So he saw them before I even knew.
Hmm.
And so they're like in a train, I guess, and they come for each other, and it's a full, full, beautiful life on the other side. It's what it's all about.
Well, I never doubted, you know, what she was telling me because, of course, I'm her daughter. I mean, I didn't have any trust issues, but it's I guess it's like you said, you make a choice at that moment to either let them go or tell them to stay.
Well, and a lot of it is once they review their life, if they just, you know, they negotiate, and you can negotiate.
Mm-hmm.
And it's mainly for their loved ones, the people they really care, like you.
Well,
and
I really have enjoyed this, and I'm so glad to know that George is a snappy dresser.
He is. Oh, my God. And I mean, he really is, and really just a funny guy, too, actually.
That just made my night because I don't want to think of you sitting there like in a T-shirt and shorts or something.
Let me tell you, man, when I was there at that conference, you should have seen all the women going after him, man.
Thanks,
no, I mean, really.
Just what I need now, huh?
I go, where's the movie star? Is there a movie star there? And it was, yes, it's George Norrie. You know, they were all like, oh, my God. But you know what? He exudes this bold power that's just really full of just love.
Oh, you really want to come back on another show, don't you, Lermer?
No, I'm just telling you who you are. You're nice. I like you. You know, you're a good guy. You know?
I know it. I'm kidding. Pulling you.
I just want you to know that.
What's new on your website, drjohnlerma.com?
Well, again, what's new is I'm just going to keep everybody informed of, you know, what I'm doing, where I'm going to be speaking, maybe other radio shows, but the big one is this quantumwisdommovie.com that's being made by Nick Mendoza.
Yeah, you got to tell us when that's ready to roll, okay?
Yeah, and that should be really cool. And there's going to be also a motion pictures being spoken of right now of the little boy, Matthew. They want to
which will be great. Hey, let's take a quick hello, by the way. We've got Patrick, and we've got Joe, and we've got Rob, and we've got Al. They didn't have time to say hi to you. Hey, guys, just say hi to Dr. John. That's her. That's her way of saying hi to you.
Hey, I love it, man. Hey back, man. That sounds like my patience.
All right, John. Take care of yourself.
All right. God bless, guys.
For Dan Galante, Jason King, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.